This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. In today's program, there was a startling development in Japan where the government has now allowed the sale of fish from Fukushima, just off the edge of the Pacific Ocean, where there is continuing radioactivity released into the ocean. Sea bass off the coast of Japan are being thrown back because they exceed radiation limits. Bluefin tuna have traveled all the way from Fukushima to the west coast of the United States, but Japanese officials say that the locally sold test produce of fish and seafood products is safe for consumption. We'll get the latest details from nuclear expert Arne Gunderson of Fair Winds Associates. Also, we'll continue the environmental theme today with a look at the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit. Recently concluded, many people say that the concept of a green economy is just a bailout for the current recession around the world. We'll hear what Bolivian President Evo Morales has to say about that. All that and more on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we turn our eyes to Fukushima, where there is an odd marketing test ploy being done by officials in and around Fukushima, the site of the multiple nuclear meltdowns and disasters there, and the continuing release of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean water table and nearby areas. We're now joined live by Arne Gunderson, a nuclear engineer, licensed plant operator, and expert for Fair Winds Associates. Welcome back, Arne.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me.
I cannot believe they're selling octopus and snails off the coast of Fukushima.
Well, you're right. I can't believe it either. It's fascinating how they've declared that octopus and snails are safe. They boiled them first, and then they checked for radiation. Of course, they didn't check the water they were boiled in, but they checked the octopus and snails after they were boiled and claim they were satisfactory. But the interesting thing is they're not selling them boiled. They're selling them raw, but yet the tests were done on boiled, which, of course, would drive off some of the radiation. So you're right. It is fascinating.
Well, now, in our prior conversation, we covered the reported transit of huge fish, tuna, across the Pacific Ocean from Japan to the west coast of the United States with the radiation levels that were detected in them that could only have come from the Fukushima disaster. You spoke about how the radiation would work its way up the food chain and that the snapshot of the most recent peer-reviewed scientific report, you said, would underestimate the continuing accumulation as days, weeks, months, and years go by. Like you to revisit that and put that in context with the alarming discovery of radiation in smaller fish near the Japanese coast near Fukushima. There was a report that we discussed earlier today about results from the Health and Labor Sciences Research Center, which found disturbing levels of cesium-134 and 137. So can you take us through the big fish and the little fish?
Sure. We'll start with the biggest fish. There was, right after the accident, cesium-137 detected in whales off the shore. But as everyone said, no one ever tested a whale before, so we're not sure what the normal whale should have. And because it was 137, that's not a signature coming from Fukushima. You need both 134 and 137. So let's go down the food chain a little bit to tuna, and but tuna were caught off the coast of California. They caught 15 fish, and all of them had both cesium-134 and 137. And they were, it was only 5 months after the accident, which meant, I don't know, can tuna do a beeline? The tuna beelined for the California coast, and yet they had a body burden of cesium-134 and 137. To me, that tells me that essentially every tuna in the Pacific is now carrying cesium-134, 137. But the report you were mentioning is even more frightening to my mind because they're relatively deep water fish, so they're not right on the coast, And I've got it in front of me. They have spotted anchovies, have the 60 becquerels per kilogram. So that means 60 clicks of a Geiger counter for every 2 pounds of spotted anchovies every second. Another one is something called a greenling, another 60 counts in a Geiger counter every second for 2 pounds of that fish. On and on and on, even down to snow crabs, which had about 15 clicks, 15 becquerels per kilogram as well. They're at the bottom of the food chain. So that's what the tuna are going to be eating, or an intermediate fish, and then working its way up. I think we said earlier, if we didn't, I'll say it now, I think those early data we got from tuna are going to be low, and we're going to find higher and higher concentrations as the year goes on.
One of the things that's important to consider in this most recent nonchalantly released report from the Health and Labor Sciences Research Center in Japan is that the species to which you refer, their radioactivity count in becquerels per kilogram was separated into plutonium, which some of them were detected as having, strontium, and but when it comes to the cesium, you are indicating that the co-presence of 134 and 137 isotopes is that which tags it to Fukushima at this point in time. And some of the reporting on this study suggests that the levels are half as large as need to be counted. You say that it's significant that both species of cesium, 134 and 137, be taken into account. Can you explain that?
Well, chemically, you know, they're identical. So they're going to, just like potassium, they're going to go to bone. They're going to go to muscle in your body. So it's quite common when you look at the biological effect of them to combine the two. Cesium-134 is actually worse than cesium-137 because it's more energetic, but it has a shorter half-life. So while it's in your muscle, which is, you know, something on the order of 10 years, it's more damaging, whereas the cesium can hang around for something on the order of a couple hundred years. So after the 134 is gone, the 137 is obviously the most dangerous isotope. The concentration that these are found at you know, 60 to 100 disintegrations per second, becquerels per kilogram, is significant. The health physics community is concerned, first for just eating the anchovies and these small fish, but if the small fish are at 100, the tuna will concentrate something on the order of 10 times that, and you'll be up at 1,000. So this bioaccumulation, as it works its way up the food chain, tells me that in the fish that we eat in quantity, you know, like a tuna steak or something like that, is likely to become contaminated as time goes on.
Well, with the radioactive anchovies being discovered off the coast of Japan near Fukushima, does that mean now that pizza can melt its own cheese?
I don't like anchovies on my pizza. But you're right, yes, it could.
Well, Arnie, one of the disturbing aspects of this development this week of selling offshore fish near Fukushima, even though the government claims that it's meeting radiation standards, is that it's being test marketed in a couple of stores near Fukushima in the prefecture there, and being sold at a discount of 30 to 40% less than it was before the nuclear disaster. Do you see this as a test probe of having economics overcome concern about environmental health?
I do think so. You know, when I was in Tokyo, there was a couple of stores that specialized in Fukushima food, and my God, they had beautiful radiation detection equipment. It was their sort of market niche, and you know, to the tune of maybe having a $50,000 detector in the store. I wish I had one in my lab. Even then, there were not many people shopping there. So there certainly is resistance, and I really don't believe that price is overgoing is going to overcome it. You know, it's interesting because while the Japanese are allowing fish to be sold now from near Fukushima, South Korea just banned 35 different seafood products from Japan. This is also today. So here in the United States, we have this "don't ask, don't tell." You know, we don't ask the Japanese what's in it, and they don't tell us. But the South Koreans are banning Japanese imports of seafood.
What about the supposed regulatory agencies, the World Trade Organization or whatever international health bodies there may be, the United Nations and such? Could it be the case that there are no standards for proper research and protection against radioactivity ingestion? Why is the international regulatory system, much less TEPCO and the Japanese government, doing something that is more proactively protective?
Well, I've been told by people in the State Department last year that that they were told by the United States government to downplay the health effects of radiation. And so I think we've really gone out of our way not to measure. It may be that there's a standard there, and the federal agencies and even the state agencies are simply not measuring the stuff. I've been working on the West Coast, and I'm trying to get the people in Oregon to demand of their state, the people in Alaska demand of your state, check the salmon. It is not difficult. It's on the order of $500 a fish. Of course, you don't have to test every fish, but let's test a couple fish and see, and either alleviate the fear or announce that yes, indeed, that they are radioactive.
In other words, don't ask, don't tell, Becquerel.
I like it.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And that is Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates. He is also a recent and frequent traveler to Japan, where he was the guest of the Japanese National Press Club on the publication of his bestseller in the Japanese language called Fukushima, The Truth and the Future. And Arne, I understand that it's not just the seafood that is showing signs of radioactivity from the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. What other ways of detecting this not being published by government agencies are you aware of?
Well, the freshwater fish are also contaminated, and the bottoms of streams and rivers and lakes are becoming more contaminated. You know, if you think about it, there's a lot on the ground, and over time the rain is going to wash it into the rivers, and it does collect in sediment, and then the bottom dwellers pick it and things like that. So we are seeing it in freshwater fish, including freshwater fish associated with like major reservoirs for Tokyo. So it's in the food chain. But what I've found disturbing, I was in Europe a couple of weeks ago, and I was speaking with a Japanese journalist who spoke fluent Italian and fluent English and came from Fukushima Prefecture. And she agreed to have people within the prefecture send us the dust from inside their vacuum cleaners. And we're beginning, so this is household dust. And we're now finding contamination in the household dust exceeding 10,000 disintegrations per second, 10,000 becquerels per second per kilogram of dust. Now, you know, up 2 pounds of dust is a lot of dust, but what I'm getting at here is that the household dust in Fukushima Prefecture is, you couldn't throw that bag out. It should be treated as radioactive waste at the numbers we're seeing. And in fact, the people are just not aware of it. So when you see people walking around with these, you know, the Geiger counter held in air, and those numbers are relatively low, I believe that, but it's not an indication of what they're really exposed to. I mean, you know, the Japanese sleep on beds that they roll out on the floor, which is exactly where the dust is. So the issue is the internal contamination that these people are either breathing in or imbibing other ways. We've also got people in Tokyo who are sending house filters, not vacuum cleaner filters, but whole house filters. And while down from last year, they are still showing significant levels of cesium as well. So we know it's airborne as far out as Tokyo, and we know it's in the soil being carried in on feet and in the households in Fukushima Prefecture. The net effect of all that will be determined in 20 or 30 years as this stuff causes cancer. My biggest concern is for women and for young children, both of which are much more radio sensitive than, an old guy like me.
You were also in communication with Marco Kaltofen, who was involved, I believe, as well with the study about the vacuum bags and the air filters of automobiles.
Well, Marco has actually not been involved in the vacuum bags. That's another scientist. And yeah, he did an extensive project on air filters for cars. And those are truly hideous. The you can go up on our website and see the pictures, but an air filter for a car, and driven in normal use, breathes in about the same amount of air as a person in the course of a day. And the air filters for cars we found in Fukushima Prefecture last year are just awful. The way we test them is we put the air filter on an X-ray sheet and put that in a dark safe for something on the order of a week. Well, the Fukushima air filters were so radioactive that they turned the X-ray film white. We had to put them in for less time because they were literally, completely burning the X-ray film. This is last year's data now. It's not new. We're still seeing it, not to the same degree. But the international community is measuring the wrong thing. They're looking at external radiation from a handheld detector, and they're not looking at what these people are imbibing or breathing in.
We're speaking with Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds. The web address is fairwinds.com, F-A-I-R-E-W-I-N-D-S. And Arne, I think we need also today to do a state of the units review of Fukushima Daiichi and certainly the scene of multiple meltdowns in Units 1, 2, and 3. But we keep our attention on Unit Number 4, where there is a bathtub perched atop a birdhouse, where the spent fuel pool overloaded from the defueling of Reactor Number 4 is sitting precariously, according to some estimates. And just this week, the Japanese government and TEPCO admitted that there is a warping, a stressing of the walls of the Unit 4 building, and insisting that there is nothing about that about which to worry. Can you bring us up to date on Unit 4?
I loved your comment last time about when the bow breaks, the baby will fall. That's sort of where we remain. It's interesting. The Japanese announced that the wall had bulged on two sides of the Fukushima Unit 4, and that's, of course, the one that has the most fuel and the hottest fuel and the most risk to cut Japan in half or to cause the evacuation of Tokyo should it fail. Now, this is really in the weeds, but when you see a building buckle like that, it's actually called a first-mode Euler strut buckle. And it's caused by a seismic-induced stress. So, of course, the industry has been saying all along that, well, these plants withstood the earthquake perfectly well. But buckling like we're seeing in Unit 4 is an indication that perhaps they didn't ride out the earthquake anywhere near as well as we thought.
The first-order Euler stress, would that be E-U-L-E-R?
Yes, named after the famous mathematician.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the Unit 4 spent fuel pool, at the latest report of which I'm aware, has had a tarpaulin, a plastic sheet, put on top of it. What is the state and complexity and reliability of the attempt to keep the remnant reactions of the fuel cool?
I think that sheet is to keep people from falling in and to keep material from falling in, because they are going to begin to build up a structure over top of it. So the tarpaulin-like cover or drumhead, if you will, that they did put over top of the fuel pool, I don't believe was meant to hold any radiation in, but in fact was designed. The last thing you want is for somebody to drop an I-beam and for that I-beam to go crashing into the nuclear fuel. And I think this was designed to catch construction rubble as it fell.
So they put a big trampoline over the lid of it.
Yes, exactly. We're going to turn you into an engineer yet.
The other problem is that people are saying that the pool should be depopulated, that the fuel should be taken out in case of the risk of losing the water, losing the cooling, zirconium, zircaloy fires and such. And I don't think we've spoken much about why that is not feasible because of the destruction of the reliability of the rolling crane that typically lies above such facilities.
No, that's exactly right. The tarpaulin that they put there is going to have a large building put over the top and for an enormous crane, one that can handle something on the order of 150 tons. And that crane has to lift into the pool a very heavy shielded cask. Only when that happens can they then lift the individual fuel bundles out and put it in that heavily shielded cask. This can't be done by a construction crane because, one, even though they look robust, they can't lift 100 tons. But the other problem is that they're not redundant. And if the cable were to snap on a construction crane while it was carrying a 100-ton cast over the fuel pool, the cast would burst right through, seven stories of the building and drain the pool in no time. So you have to be very careful not to drop the cask. So they'll build a building over top of this pool so they can lift in this heavily shielded cask. Once that heavily shielded cask is underwater, they will very gingerly lift out the nuclear fuel bundles underwater because they are so radioactive they would, kill the operating crew on the operating deck if they were to lose water. They'll then put those into the cask and lift them out using that same heavy lift crane.
I believe it's Kirchhoff's law that says that the amount of a thing going into a node equals the amount of a thing coming out of a node. About the water that is being used to try and keep the spent fuel pool cooled, what happens to the water that is circulated into it? Does it really all come back and get recirculated, or is there still leakage into the water table and the Pacific?
There definitely is leakage into the water table and into the Pacific from all of the units. I don't think you can quantify whether it's predominantly from Unit 4 or Unit 1 or whatever, but the buildings continue to leak into the water table and into the Pacific. Now, I went on record a year ago saying that a solution should be to build a trench and fill it about 2 meters wide, 6 feet wide by 60 feet deep, and fill it with something called zeolite, which is a volcanic material that absorbs radiation. And I was told, quite frankly, that Tokyo Electric didn't have the money to build a trench around the facility. So a lot of good engineering solutions seem to be limited not by the creativity of engineers, but by the ability of Tokyo Electric to fund what could easily be important dose-minimizing missions.
Well, this is quite a severe survey that you bring us today of the circumstances at Fukushima. We've been speaking with Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, the author of Fukushima, The Truth and the Future. And Arne, in the minute or two that we have now, I'd like you to tell us about what you're doing or how people can learn more through Fairwinds or other methods as well.
Well, July 1 is a very important day in Japan. The Ohai units are scheduled to start up, and there's enormous popular pressure not to. Every Friday for the last 3 weeks, people have surrounded the building in which the prime minister lives. 2 weeks ago, there was 10,000. A week ago, there was 45,000, and they're expecting 100,000 this week. So I think your listeners might want to keep an eye on that, although mainstream media hasn't covered it. Also, Fairwinds is going to be putting up on the first a new video. We've been invited to be the kickoff act for the Japanese Peace Film Festival, and so we've got a new video discussing The fact that Japan has alternatives, that they don't have to go back and fire up 50 nuclear plants. They can engineer their way out of this using alternatives over the next 10 years, like the Germans are planning to do. And I think those are the lessons I'd like to leave with your listeners.
Well, thank you so much. I commend attention to your website at fairwinds.com and support for someone who's doing some very important research and teaching. Thank you, Arne Gunderson.
Thanks for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We'll be back with more after this.
Seen beneath the ocean, a fish species scientist explorer, having traveled the seven seas and thereby having knowledge of Earth land, is communicating the concept of a Darwinian theory to other sea creatures and members of the fish and sea family gathered there to hear him. He speaks and says, "Born of fishdom, sea creatures and all included in oceanic membership, I know it's hard to conceive, but you must believe there is beyond our watered sky a place where the spirits of our ancestors dwell, called hell. They're fearful-looking creatures there, with features bearing no resemblance to the fin-like ways of us. They're monstrous, with no evidence of ever having been akin with fin. Their skin, no scales, breathing pure oxygen. They live on land. Can you understand the horror of their change? Strange how they used to be as we, members of the fish species. They call themselves now humankind. And as they live, they leave behind them devastation. Horrible annihilation of all the others here to share the earth as brother. They live as demons, and they try, if you should go too near our watered sky, to sneer you and spear you and tear you with their hooks and drag you to their atmosphere of, to us, suffocating air. Creatures that are there to fly are being driven from their sky, polluted by the acrid vapors of the selfish human capers. Everything that grows with beauty has become the sacred duty of the human to destroy. So woods are fallen, burned, and broken as a token added to the misery of the human history. Fish species once, they're now returning to the sea, I fear. Oh, children, listen to me. We must not allow them here. They have built machines and are exploring far and deep. And soon they'll come to dwell, bringing with them hell and other human horrors. So beware. Prepare to protect the life we live here in our sea. Gather all together and to be an impossibility for them to penetrate. If we concentrate, we can be stronger than the human. fish and whales and octopi and the demons of the deep and the mermen, maids and myths and the monsters. Rise up from your sleep. Come together now and join the seaweed and the plants and plankton. Gather moss, elements and currents. Ride them roughly should they try to dry us dead with their chicanery. And instead, destroy them, winds of outraged nature, lest they change the nomenclature of the universe. Oh, stop them! Let us stop them with our passion, should they try their fearful fashion of expand and conquer on us. Let us dwell and wash them all away for good, and clean the earth of what they wrought as cruel men. And then we'll start again and be a world ruled by the fish species.
Sea creatures and all included in oceanic membership. I know it's hard to conceive, but you must believe. There is a beyond our waters sky, a place where none the spirits of our ancestors dwell.
Did you recognize yourself there, fellow?
Fellow human!
They're fearful looking creatures there.
With features, fellow human!
Fish Species by Lincoln Chase. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and the recently concluded so-called Earth Summit, the Rio Plus 20 summit that addressed the environment, was called a failure by quite a number of environmentalists because they say that the summit neglected the issues of reparation and restoration of the global ecology for the benefit of a short-term budget goal under the rubric or the name of the so-called green economy. Among the speakers at that summit was the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, who touches on some of these subjects.
Thank you very much. Members of the presidency of this conference on sustainable development, I'd like to commend brother presidents, representatives from around the world, and I'd also bring my greetings to this Brazilian government, for the organization, and for the Brazilian people who have shouldered this organization as well. I take this opportunity to underscore the fact that the peoples of the South today are celebrating our new Andean Amazonic region from Intinamtite in Quechua, the Festival of the Sun, Incaputi in Aymara, the return of Father Sun. These are cosmic signs which show us and have taught us for centuries about Mother Earth. Today is a holiday in Bolivia. We are celebrating the Amazonic Day and the Andean Day, and we are celebrating all the peoples of the South, especially the indigenous people. 20 years ago, the Earth Summit was held here in Brazil, and thus this is important for deep-seated reflection on life and on mankind, taking into account our Mother Earth. And I recall, as a union leader, that we had a message from a great wise man, Fidel Castro, who was the president and commander of revolutionary Cuba. And he told us at the time, let's end hunger, not man. Let's pay the environmental debt, not the external debt. 20 years have elapsed now. And we need to set aside the debt of the capitalist world. And we need to pay the environmental debt and not the external debt. At this time, we feel that the countries of the capitalist system have an unpayable debt, and the so-called poor nations or developing nations, our situation is now better than before. And that's why at this conference I feel it's important to engage in deep-seated reflection, taking into account future generations. Yesterday, during the general debate, we heard about the green economy. In keeping with the sentiments of social agents throughout the world, especially the indigenous peoples, what do we understand by green economy when we say that? Do we mean environmentalism? The green economy, is that the new color for subjugating our peoples to the capitalist system? Environmentalism for capitalism is a new form of colonialism, a two-part form, mercantilizing the natural sources of life. And it is a form of colonialism of the southern countries who on their shoulders carry the responsibility of protecting the environment, which is destroyed by the capitalist industrial economy of the north. And mercantilist natural environmentalism converts every tree, every plant, and every drop of water, and everything from nature into something to sell, subject to the dictatorship of the market. The dictatorship of the market privatizes wealth and socializes poverty. Environmentalism usurps creativity of nature. And nature is the common heritage of all living beings, and it expropriates it for private profit-making. On behalf of those who care for nature, environmentalism is an imperial system which quantifies every single plant, product, drop of water, every natural thing is turned into money, into business making and profits. And it does so with the short term in view, with a view to private appropriation of this natural wealth for more economic gain. environmentalism and measuring the usefulness of nature in terms of money is colonizing nature, because it is turning the very source of life of all generations into a private asset for the benefit of just a few people. And for that reason, environmentalism is just a way of realizing destructive capitalism. It's just another way of enslaving nature. But beyond that, capitalist environmentalism is also a form of predatory colonialism, because it insists that the developed countries' commitments of preserving nature for future generations is something that is to be imposed on the so-called developing countries, whilst the developed countries focus their efforts on the commercial destruction of the environment. And the countries of the North are enriching themselves in a frenzy of using the resources, while we are the guardians in the poor South. They determine our sovereignty over our own natural resources, limiting our own use of them and benefit from them. They want to create an investment mechanism to monetize and judge our national policies. They claim that they are judging and punishing the use of natural resources with environmental arguments. They wish a weak state with weak institutions, which are submissive, so that we give up our natural resources to them, as has always happened in our history. For that reason, it's extremely important to engage in deep reflection at this international conference, where we have representatives from around the world. How does capitalism promote mercantilism and capitalism of biodiversity, making a business of biological resources and biodiversity? They make it a business. And when I think about that, I reach the following conclusion. Life is not a right. It's just a business, another business for capitalism, which is using the environment to its own ends at this conference. Dear Presidents, it is not possible to have the so-called civilization of some 200 or 300 years. We cannot allow it to destroy harmonious life that indigenous peoples lived for over 5,000 years. That's our deep-seated difference here. The difference between the West and the countries of the South, and especially the difference in the civilizations that live in harmony with Mother Earth. A small contribution from Bolivia. The Senate 2 days ago approved the law for Mother Earth to live well and in good health, and that we must live in harmony and in balance with Mother Earth to build a fair and equitable society based on solidarity and a reduction of poverty. We must work in a complementary fashion, which is complementary with the following rights: the rights of Mother Earth, the rights of the indigenous peoples, the rights of the poor to overcome poverty, and the rights of the Bolivian people to live well, the right and obligation of the state to promote sustainable development. We cannot develop ourselves without affecting nature, nor by destroying nature. And for that reason, our law proposes complementarity of the rights. Above and beyond that, our law also creates the plurinational climate justice entity in order to manage climate change and mitigation and adaptation to climate change. The body was created by the law that was just enacted by the Senate. I'd now like to just tell you an anecdote. recovering our natural resources. In Bolivia, we has thereby improved our national economy working in this way. And I could give you three examples of this. The largest Bolivian company, which is the Petro Company of the Bolivian, in 2005 only had $300 million. After nationalizing fossil fuels this year, in a very short period of time, we've improved our economy. And this year, our company will receive $3.5 billion due to the efforts of the Bolivian people and due to the mandate, which is to nationalize our natural resources. We know that we are a small country. We're called a poor country, a developing country. And our international reserves in 2005 amounted to $1.7 billion. This year, we've reached $13 billion national reserves. Public investment in Bolivia in 2005, before I reached the presidency, were $600 million. And above and beyond that, 70% of the $600 million were in the form of credit or donations. This year, public investment is to reach more than $5 billion. So you can just imagine what has happened to our economy after recovering ownership of our own fossil fuels and how that translates in terms of the economy. Now, this is important experience in terms of recovering our own fossil fuels. With all due respect to the countries of Africa and around the world, they need to recover their natural resources and nationalize them. These are the natural resources of your peoples, and they should not be the business of multinational corporations. I'd also like to tell you another experience, a true experience in our country. Basic services should never be subject to private companies' control. Again, in Bolivia, we had privatized water and telecommunications before I reached the presidency, and now we've started to recover those resources. And our way of recovering the basic services as a state obligation, not privatization, not a multinational business, helping us to solve our social problems, which are so important in Bolivia. Dear colleagues present here, ladies and gentlemen, it's important to really think about the future generations. We have to stop the models based on looting. We need to put an end to the capitalist system. Capitalism is not a solution. And now I really regret saying this, but quite seriously, I have very carefully followed the so-called green economy. Once again, let me reiterate, the green economy is a new form of colonialism to subjugate peoples and governments who are anti-capitalist and anti-imperialistic, and that's why we need to reflect carefully here. For the well-being of future generations, if we wish to have this event go into the annals of history, we need to think carefully. We have no alternative but to approve documents that would put an end to policies, be they environmental or economic, be they social policies, that are geared to saving lives and mankind. That's what we should work towards. And we need to stop with the killing of people and move to a model based on humanism. That is important for everyone around the world. Thank you very much, President, for your attention. And I hope we will continue to all work together for the future generations. Thank you.
Bolivian President Evo Morales, addressing the just concluded United Nations-sponsored so-called Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit for Sustainable Development. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, with production by Thiago Barroso and engineering by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, suggestions, tips, and leaks, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.